Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio, brought to you by the OU Israel Center in Yerushalayim. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky. Today is Yom Chamishi B'Shabbat Parshat Matot, Thursday of the week in which we read from the weekly portion called Matot, Kaf Aleph Tammuz, Tafshin Samachei, the 21st of Tammuz, the year 5765, Thursday, July 28th, 05, and this week's show is, you guessed it, for Parshat Matot. We bench Rosh Chodesh Menachem of the Shabbat. We'll talk about that too. But first, Psalm 130, Tehillim Kuf Lamed, which sadly seems more and more and more appropriate to say, rather than going in the direction of the day when we can say a more happy and peppy Tehillim in thanks to God for the situation in which we find ourselves. Here we are calling to Him from the depths to answer our prayers and improve our situation. Shir HaMa'alot Mima'amakim Karaticha Adonai. Adonai Shima V'Koli Tihyena Aznecha Kashuvot L'Kol Tachanunai. Im Avonot Tishmor Yah Adonai Miya Amod. Ki imacha haslicha lema'an tivarei. Ki viti Adonai ki vita nafshi, vilidvoro hocholti. Nafshi l'Adonai, mi shomerim laboker, shomerim laboker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai, ki im Adonai hachesed, v'harbe imo fedut. V'hu yifde et Yisrael, mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanetunim batzara uvashivya, Ha'omidim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, ha'makom yirachem aleihem v'yotziyem mitzara lirvacha, u'me'afela la'ora u'mishibud l'geula, hashta ba'agala u'vizman kariv v'nomar amen. The idea expressed in that Tehillim of calling to God mima'amakim, from the depths, from dire straits, reminds one of bein ha'mitzarim, which literally, I think, is in dire straits, both literally and figuratively. Bein HaMitzarim is the term that is synonymous with what we would say in English, the 3 weeks, the period of mourning the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash from Shivasar B'Tammuz until Tisha B'Av, really until noon of Yud B'Av. And the more common term in Hebrew is Bein HaMitzarim, although Shlosha Shavuot, or some form of that, is also used. I think English speakers are more familiar with the 3 weeks, but the formal official term is Bein HaMitzarim. So if any time is appropriate for Psalm 130, it is now. And I don't only refer to the calendar, I refer to the situation that we happen to be in. Here, as everyone is aware, with the impending implementation of the disengagement plan, to use the official, although not the term that a lot of people like to use, the situation is bad at its best and very, very bad at its worst. I was going to describe some of the bad stuff, but I don't think I will. The good stuff, what do I see? I see pictures in the newspapers sometimes, and I hear stories of protesters and soldiers, protesters and policemen, davening mincha together. But the negative stories are bad. I hope this doesn't sound corny, but I think that we have to believe very strongly that our tefillot, our prayers, our Torah learning, our mitzvah observance, especially but not exclusively in the area of Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, interpersonal mitzvot, will all convey to God, so to speak, that we are not happy with the situation and we would like to see things change for the better. And you have to believe in the power of prayer. Doesn't stop us from protesting. It doesn't stop people from taking other steps which would fall under the category of hishtadlus, effort. You cannot leave things only to prayer unless there's absolutely nothing to do. But if there is something to do, then one is duty-bound to try and do things. And people are doing things, so let's hope for the best. Over the years of Torah Tidbits Audio, during Sfirat HaOmer and during the 3 weeks, we have restricted the music to low-key, sad kind of stuff, and especially the a cappella, the no musical instrumentation kind of albums, which are very common now. They advertise for Sfirat HaOmer, the 3 weeks, and the whole year, meaning don't not play the music other times, but it's music that definitely is appropriate for this time. To give you an example, I'm going to play a clip from the album HaMakhela, the choir. Yochi Briskman presents. We've played it in the past, has different songs. Participating artists include Shlomi Dax, Yisrael Williger, Yossi Rosenberg, Gidon Levine, and this part of a track is Rachem Bechastacha. It comes from the Zmirot of Friday night, Tzur Mishalo, third stanza, and asks God to give us his mercy, bring the Mashiach and rebuild Yerushalayim. This clip, Rachem Bechastacha.
Mashiach, Mashiach. Mashiach Hashem.
Okay, let's ease ourselves into the show. We have Parshat Matot, we have Rosh Chodesh benching of Rosh Chodesh being the following Shabbat. Of is always a one-day Rosh Chodesh. Tammuz always has 29 days in our fixed calendar. There has been, in past generations, I would say, a question as to whether we should not have an announcement of Rosh Chodesh Av. If the Mishnah says, Misha Nichnas Av Mim'atim B'Simcha, when Av enters, we diminish in joy, then why announce its coming? Let it come if it has to, and we will do what we have to do, but the joyful announcement of Rosh Chodesh, which we call Rosh Chodesh benching, seems a little out of sync with the seriousness of the month of Av. The prevailing opinion was that we're talking about invoking a blessing from God for the coming month, the month which we are announcing now, and if any month needs a blessing, it's the month of Av. The first 9.5 days of the month are the culmination of the 3-week period of mourning for the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, and the heavier part of that mournful period. At noon, halachic noon of the 10th of Av, the day following Tisha B'Av, which would mean Monday this year, since Tisha B'Av is a Saturday night, Sunday, at that point, Nechama, comfort, takes over, and sure enough, the month of Av is equipped with two names to suit those purposes. There is a custom to refer to the month as Av for the first 10 days, thereafter referring to it as Menachem Av, Menachem meaning comfort. So we will bench Rosh Chodesh this Shabbat. We will say Rosh Chodesh Menachem Av. First of all, the majority of the month is the Nechama portion of it, and not the mournful part. Second, what we want to focus on is that Nechama, that comfort. And what we want to hope and pray for is that the month of Av become a happy month, because Tisha B'Av is destined to become a Yom Tov of some sort, with the Geula Shlema, the complete redemption, the building of the Beit HaMikdash, and the restoration of Yerushalayim, Jerusalem, and Eretz Yisrael to its glory. So we definitely have Rosh Chodesh benching this Shabbos, and it should be said with a hopeful anticipation joy, as well as a now and Im Yirtzeh Hashem soon, because that's the way Jews work anyway. It's never only white or black. It's very often white and black mixed together. And it doesn't often produce shades of gray. It stays a swirl of black and white. Keep that image in your mind and ponder it. Another aspect of Rosh Chodesh Av is that it is the Yortzeit of Aharon HaKohen, but I think we'll talk about that next week. And let's get back to Parshat Matot. Before we go into the content of Matot, let me say, as is known, that it is a rare occurrence that Matot is separated from Mas'eh. Of the 7 pairs of Sedras that are sometimes combined, sometimes separated, Matot and Mas'eh are the most combined. They form the longest Torah reading, the horror of a bar mitzvah boy who happens to get hit with Matot Mas'eh, 244 psukim. But I really shouldn't call it a horror. There's nice stuff in it, as there is in all Sedras. But it's a particular fear of a bar mitzvah boy. And when he has friends whose bar mitzvah Sedras are Ha'azinu or Cholamoid Pesach or something like that, then he gets jealous comparing how much he has to prepare compared to what his friends prepared. In any event, Matot and Maseh are most often together. They separate, odd as this sounds, in Shana Me'uberet, a leap year, a 13-month year, a 2-Adar year, that begins on a Thursday. This year, 5765, is a year type that has Rosh Hashanah on Thursday, Friday. There are 2 year types when that happens. It could be a year with Cheshvan and Kislev both having 29 days. It could be called Chaser, deficient. It could be a year where Cheshvan and Kislev both have 30 days, known as Shalem. In both cases, a Shana Me'uberet that begins on a Thursday, 2 different year types for a total frequency occurrence of 10.5%. 10.5% of the time, Matot and Maseh will be separated. All the rest of the time, they will be combined. A frequency of 10.5% means a little more often than 1 year out of 10 will have this situation of a split Matot Maseh. But the distribution of the year types is not uniform, and it turns out that the last time the Matot Maseh were split for this reason of a Shana Me'uberet beginning on a Thursday was 21 years ago. The next time it'll happen is scheduled for 3 years from now, and the time after that another 3 years, and the time after that another 3 years. So it's just an illustration that this is not very neat in its distribution. However, a person who does not remember the last time is excused because it was 21 years ago. Now, all of that I have said till now is correct for Chutz La'aretz, any place outside of Eretz Yisrael. In the land of Israel, there is an additional circumstance which will split Matot and Maseh, which does not affect Chutz La'aretz. And that is also a Shana Me'uberet, when Pesach is Shabbat through Friday. Our 7 days of Pesach, Shabbat, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, which means the following day, Shabbat, we are still Pesachtik. There's no chametz around. The dishes in the house and the food is all kosher of Pesach. But for us, it is not Pesach anymore. We go back to reading the regular Parshat HaShavua, the portion of the week. While in Chutz La'aretz, outside of Israel, people are celebrating the 8th day of Pesach with a special Torah reading, thus postponing regular weekly portion for 1 more week. We get out of sync. We read a Sedra that day. That same Sedra is read the following week in Chutz La'aretz when we're reading the next one. The getting back into sync is accomplished by taking a double Sedra and in Israel splitting it. That will delay us a week and we come back even with Chutz La'aretz. The only available double Sedra is approximately 16 weeks after Pesach, namely Matot Maseh, and in those kind of years we will split it also. That adds another 10% to the frequency of those kind of years, so the experience of a split Matot Maseh for us in Israel is a 20.5% possibility, the last one happening only 10 years ago, but it's still a long time. In other words, it is not that common that Matot is separated from Maseh. One of the things that comes along with this is the Haftorah. Last week, we had a regular Haftorah for Parshat Pinchas, because it took place before the 3 weeks began, specifically the day before Shivos Arba Tammuz. This week, this Shabbat, Parshat Matot, is the first of the 3 weeks of tragedy, they are called, calamity, and the Haftorah that is read for Matot is the first chapter of Yirmiyahu and the first three psukim of the second chapter. Next week for Maaseh, we continue from chapter 2, pasuk 4, for the Haftorah for Maaseh, and the week after, Devarim, as is always, Shabbat Chazon, the reading is from the beginning of the book of Yeshayahu, Isaiah. In any event, that's the story. That's this Shabbat. Parshat Matot on its own, Haftorah from the beginning of the book of Yirmiyahu, the first of the 3 weeks of tragedy, and we've got it now down pat, I hope. As long as we're on the subject of double sedras splitting and separating, let me add the following without getting too complicated. This year, 5765, its year type is unique among the 14 kinds of Jewish years on the calendar, in that none of the sedra pairs that sometimes are combined are actually combined. This year type, and no other year type, we read one sedra on a Shabbat, no doubling up at all. Now, follow these numbers. 55 Shabbatot this year. 5765 has 55 Shabbatot. Of those 55 Shabbatot, we don't read Parshat HaShavua, we didn't and we don't, on Yom Kippur, which was Shabbat, Shabbat Chol HaMoed Sukkot, and this year, the 7th of Pesach. Those three were the holidays that have their own special Torah reading, and therefore not regular Parshat HaShavua, leaving us 52 Shabbatot for Parshat HaShavua. One Parsha is not read on Shabbat usually, never in Chutz Laretz, usually not in Israel either, and that is Vizot HaBracha, which is on Simchat Torah. So leave that one out, leaves us 53 Sedras for 52 Shabbatot. So how did we do it? How will we do it? The answer is that Parshat Vayelech is not read at all this year. How is that possible? Stay tuned and you will find out. But before we get to the answer, let's have another piece of a track of HaMakhela, this song, Bilavavi, a song based on the writings of the author of Sefer Charedim, a beautiful poem which describes the kind of commitment a Jew ought to have towards God and his Judaism.
Oh,
Bilavavi. We were talking about the uniqueness of this particular year type. 5765 is a year type coded Mem He Chet, which means that it's a 13-month year. If you remember, there were two Adars this year. Rosh Hashanah was a Thursday, and Kislev 30 was missing. It's one of 14 year types, the only one where no Sedras are doubled up. So I had made the statement, we went through the reckoning of the Shabbatot and the number of Parshiot in the Torah, and to reconcile it, I said that Vayelech is not read at all during 5765, which is an oddity of the calendar, but it's cute. Vayelech, last year, at the very end of 5764, was the Shabbat before Rosh Hashanah, so we laned Vayelech last year. This year, 5765, did not begin with Vayelech. This year ends on Shabbat Parshat Nitzavim by itself, and that's it for 5765. The first Shabbat of 5766, Im Yirtzeh Hashem, we will read Vayelech. So, in essence, none of the Shabbatot during 5765 do we have Vayelech. That, taking off Vayelech and taking off Azot HaBracha, leaves 52 Sedras for the 52 Shabbatot that we need Parshat HaShavua, no doubles. That's the way it works, and no other year works like that. Let's just go one tiny more step and say that because on Monday and Thursday and Shabbat Mincha, we read the beginning of the upcoming Parshat HaShavua, so at the very end of 5765, we are scheduled on the last Shabbat and on Monday morning, Erev, Rosh Hashanah being Tuesday, to read the beginning of Vayelech. You have a piece of 13 psukim, if I'm not mistaken, out of 30, which means that during this year we do read part of Vayelech, and the last 17 psukim of Vayelech are the only psukim, 17 out of 5,846 psukim in the whole Torah, that are not read even once during 5765. What does it mean? Nothing special, just for your statistical edification. Let's listen to another part of a track of Hamakhela, and then we'll get into Parshat Matot in earnest. Al Naharot Bavel.
Al Naharot Bavel. Offering.
Break Parshat Matot into three parts, really. The first part deals with vows, oaths, pledges, promises, etc., both the strict requirement of keeping them, as well as the method or methods of annulling them in certain circumstances. Then we have the war, the battle against Midian, which was commanded at the beginning of Parshat Pinchas, and only comes to Bitsua, to be carried out in Parshat Matot, the aftermath of the battle, the spoils of war and how they were divided, and anything related to that, one of the offshoots of that section, are the halachot related to tovaling kelim for Kedushat Yisrael, as well as kashering of kelim from non-kosher use to kosher use. But that's all part of the battle against Midian and its aftermath. And the last portion of Matot deals with the request of the tribes of Reuven and Gad to settle the east side of the Jordan River, and all of the ramifications and implications from there, Moshe Rabbeinu's reaction, and then the oath that he administered to them, and the cities they built in order to accommodate their families and their flocks until they would return after the wars in Eretz Yisrael itself and conquest and settling of the land. So it's really three different sections. Let's talk a little bit about the first. Follow me on this. There's an interesting interplay. First, you have the concept that if a person makes a vow, swears to something, he has to keep it. It's couched in a prohibition, lo yachel devaro. He may not profane his word. He may not break his word. And couched in a positive terminology, kechol hayotze mipiv ya'aseh, all that comes out of his mouth he shall do. Taking vows is very serious. This is not the only place the Torah discusses it, but wherever it's discussed, it's a very serious kind of thing. Either vows in general, or the specific vows of the Nazirite, the Nazir. Several places in the Torah deal with this topic. Here is basically a one-verse summary. A person who makes a pledge or swears to something can't violate it and has to keep it. Then the Torah goes on to another 14 verses to discuss two exceptions to the ironclad nature of a vow. The case of a father and his 12-year-old and not yet 12-and-a-half-year-old Na'ara daughter. When she makes a vow, he, the father, has the authority and the power to annul the vow on the day he hears about it only. If he lets it sit for a while, he no longer can nullify that vow, and then her, the Na'ara's, vow is treated like everyone else, which we'll get to in a moment. Similarly, but different, a wife who makes certain kind of vows or takes certain kinds of oaths, her vows and oaths can be nullified by her husband, again under certain circumstances, which we won't get into now. But in both cases, and remember I described it as a 14-verse section, these are basically the exception to the rule that when a person takes a vow, he has to keep it. Here's a situation where a 12-year-old girl makes a vow, whatever it is. Could be to put 16 holes in her ear for earrings. It could be not to go to school or whatever. And the father, different from anyone else in any other kind of relationship, the father has the authority to say, I hereby nullify that vow, and it is null and void. This does not necessarily require the daughter to do one thing or another. It just releases her from a vow. Another person would not have that method of release. This method is called hafarat nidarim. Hafarat with a fe, or an F, as in falafel and frank. Hafarat nidarim, father to daughter, certain circumstances, husband to wife's neder, certain circumstances. And then there is a third element, a second method of nullifying a vow, called hatarat nidarim. This is a procedure, without going into all the details, of a person appearing before a panel of three that forms a technical Beit Din, or before a one Rav who's an expert on the laws of vows, and he requests being released from a vow. Now, so far, the major question would be, well, what do you say? The Torah said if a person makes a vow, he has to keep it and he can't go against his word. Now you're telling me that a father and a husband can nullify certain vows of daughter and wife? Okay. Now you're telling me that anybody can have a vow and have it under certain circumstances. Not all vows are capable of being nullified, but that a person would be able to have a vow nullified, which means no longer binding on him, and in some cases, that's considered a praiseworthy good thing to do. So which is it? Is it that the Torah says if you make a vow, a pledge, a promise, an oath, you have to keep it and you may not violate the terms of that pledge, and that what you say you have to do, or can you nullify your vow? The answer is both. They are binding unless they are nullified, and both are taken very seriously. Okay, let's say I accept that, which of course is the halacha, so I have to accept it. There are vows which you have to keep. There's the ability to nullify a vow. All right. Where does it say it? And here is the particularly interesting point. The Torah says very clearly if a person makes a vow or takes an oath, he may not profane those words. What comes out of his mouth, he must do. The Torah does not say anywhere in writing, in the written Torah, that you can nullify an oath or a vow. The only thing it mentions, very specifically, is the father of the Na'ara daughter and the husband of a wife. Other than that, a regular person, man or woman, boy from bar mitzvah age, girl from bat mitzvah age, who is not in the category of Na'ara and or wife, can make a vow, and the Torah does not supply a way out of it. And here's the point. The Torah does supply the concept of nullification of vows, but it isn't in writing. Hatarat Nidarim, the Mishnah describes as Porchin Ba'avir. It hovers in the air and is not anchored to any text. Nonetheless, says the Mishnah in Chagiga, Mishnah, Perek 1, Mishnah 8, that it is no less part of the body of halacha. How much text, whether it be very little or none at all, or a lot of text, does not make or break the status of an area of Jewish law. Because our Torah is comprised of the written word, what's called Torah Shebichtav, and the oral law called Torah Sheba'al Peh. Those two together are the inseparable halves, or parts, of the total of Torah. If you take that all together as a package deal, and you add to that Talmudic and rabbinic traditions and legislation and everything else beyond the written word and the oral law, that's the package deal of Judaism, that we would, let's say, use the general term halacha, then you have no problem here. The Torah gives more or less equal weight, and I say more or less on purpose, you'll see why in a moment, to making a vow and having it stick, and releasing one from a vow. A very crucial aspect of whether a vow can be released or not is where the person's heart is in addition to where his mouth was. In other words, even though a neder, a vow, a pledge, a promise, an oath, etc., comes by the power of speech, Jewish law recognizes that the heart of the person, the intent of the person, has to be synchronized with what he said. And if there is valid reason to suspect that his heart is not together with his mouth, then the Torah gives the authority to the Beit Din or to the Rav expert to nullify, to unbind the person from his vow. A person can't do it himself. Why? Because the Torah says, Lo yachel devaro, you may not profane your word. But there's a sort of an implication, or at least an inference, drawn from that based on the oral law, that it is possible for someone else, under certain circumstances, to unbind your word. And that's exactly how Hatarat Nedarim works. Well, let's say there's a person who decided that he's going to stand for the Torah reading every Shabbat. And he does it week after week, and it becomes day after day, and it becomes a commitment. It becomes like a vow. And then he discovers, as he gets older, that it's very painful to stand all the time, and he would like to sit down. He can go through a process by which he says to the Beit Din, I undertook, without really saying b'li neder, that it was not a vow, a repeated action of mine that committed me to stand for Torah reading. But my feet hurt. And they could say, had you realized that there would come a time where it would be very uncomfortable and distracting to stand, would you have still made such a commitment? Person says, no, I wouldn't have. Then basically what they're saying is the heart and the lips were not synchronized, and they have the power to unbind the person from that vow. Let's leave it at that, because we've really eaten up a lot of the time, and I want to do a little bit of mention of what's coming next. God commands Moshe, it is time to avenge Bnei Yisrael. Previously, Moshe has referred to this as avenging God, and it's a very nice mutual kind of thing, that God is doing this for us and we're doing it for him. But because of what Midian did, hired themselves out in the form of Bilam to curse the people, and then prostituted themselves in order to draw the Israelites into the orgiastic worship of Baal Peor, and a plague which killed 24,000 Jews until it was stopped by the act of Pinchas, God declared that this nation should be wiped out and sent Israel to do it. 12,000 soldiers were chosen for the task, and they succeed. 5 Midianite kings are named, Evi, Rechem, Tsur, Hur, and Reva, as well as Bilam ben Baor, died by the sword. And unlike the battles that were to come in Eretz Yisrael, where there was no taking of booty, here the people were allowed to do that, and the Torah describes in great detail and full numbers the number of flocks, goats and sheep, the cattle, the donkeys that were taken, and on a different level, the human captives, which were only very young girls. All the males were killed, and the adult women were killed as well. And the ones that were taken, which numbered 32,000, were used probably as some kind of servant slash shivcha. But the Torah does not go into detail there. What it does is explain is that there was a split of the booty, half for the army that fought, half for the nation. And if you look at the numbers, you realize that each soldier gets much more than each individual citizen, which seems to be fair. Each one had a certain percentage tax to pay, which went to the Beit HaMikdash and went to Levium. In exploring why the Torah is so detailed on the booty, several commentaries and several people that I spoke to point out that it was to emphasize the magnitude of this action at God's command because of the terrible desecration of his name and the terrible attack against his people, the Jewish people, which resulted in this overwhelming victory, we'll say. Moving right along, we next have the Torah telling us that the tribes of Reuven and Gad had a tremendous amount of flocks, and they saw the land on the east side of the Jordan, which is where they were camped now, to be particularly good for grazing, and they suggested and then asked for permission to settle there. Moshe Rabbeinu's first reaction was anger, because he saw the sin of the spies reemerging after 40 years of wandering and paying the price of that original sin of the spies, and here people would again be discouraged from going into Israel. The situation was calmed down at God's command and with the deal that was made with the tribes that they would set their families up and then they would go with the rest of their brethren into Eretz Canaan in order to do battle there and return only when everything was settled in Eretz Yisrael itself. Half the tribe of Manasseh was to join Reuven and Gad on the east side of the Jordan, where the 9.5 tribes would be on the west side. And that's basically the Sedra. A quick word about the Haftorah. It comes from the opening of the book of Yirmiyahu. It prophesies the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, but it ends with the hopeful note that God remembers the kindness we did to him by following him through the Midbar for 40 years, and that he considers us to be holy to him, the first fruits of his yield, and those that attack us will eventually, evil will come upon them, thus says God. The bulk of the Haftorah is hard to listen to, but we need it. And the fact that it has that light at the end of the tunnel, we need that also. Jewish history is filled, unfortunately, sadly, with dark tunnels. But there is always the light at the end of the tunnel, and that, hopefully, will prevent us from despair. I say this about what occurred 2,000 years ago, and 2,500 years ago, and what's happening today. Light at the end of the tunnel. Believe it, pray for it, and we will be privileged to have it. Shabbat Shalom and Lehishtameah.